Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. I'm Neil Carruth, sorry.
Sitting in for Ken this week, we have a special guest, Neil Carruth. Welcome to the podcast, Neil.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here, Ron.
And since you are here, Neil is our elections unit editor, and he is very well versed in all of this year's campaigns. So let me ask you the big question of the week. The twin wins for Mitt Romney? Is he set up again now as the front runner? Is it all downhill from here?
I haven't really been following politics. I thought this was a podcast about knitting, but it would seem that Mitt Romney's pair of wins on Tuesday in Arizona and Michigan may have quieted, at least for a few hours, the fevered speculation over a brokered or contested convention in Tampa. But just over the horizon, Tuesday is Super Tuesday, and we have 10 states, and it would seem, based on current trends and most recent polls, like we may have a patchwork of results. It's possible that each of the four remaining Republican candidates in the field could win at least one state.
I'm guessing here that you're throwing Alaska to Ron Paul. He's going up there, putting on the mucklucks.
That's right. He's the only man, you know, making the long trip to Alaska and back before Tuesday.
And of course, there is natural appeal for a libertarian in Alaska. They've got a pretty healthy libertarian party up there, pretty large. And maybe he could actually bring home a state.
That's right. This could be the first state in the Ron Paul column.
And then, of course, we're looking to Newt Gingrich to be at least a contender in his state of New Georgia, which he hasn't actually lived in very often for very long, and he's not a native Georgian, but he claims it as his home state.
Newt Gingrich is a native Pennsylvanian.
Like Rick Santorum. That,
actually, I believe
Rick Santorum was not born in Pennsylvania.
Winchester, Virginia.
What do you know? That is correct.
Yeah, Winchester, Virginia.
You win the special deep double jeopardy buried question award this week. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay. He has himself said that Georgia will be an important state for him, an important test for him on Tuesday.
He has virtually said that if he doesn't win in Georgia, it's very hard for him to go forward. He set up this test of we should each win our home states.
That's right. Mitt Romney should win Michigan, which he now has. Rick Santorum should win Pennsylvania, which doesn't hold its primary for a while. And I, Newt Gingrich, should win Georgia.
That's right. So we have a possibility, since we expect Rick Santorum to win at least a couple of places, and we expect Mitt Romney to win in Massachusetts, one of his home states. We expect him to do well in Vermont, mm-hmm. nearby.
And Virginia, where he's only one of two candidates.
That's
on,
right.
on the ballot.
It's him or Ron Paul in right. Virginia, and we don't expect a huge Ron Paul surge in Virginia. So there are a few right there for Mitt Romney. We expect him to do well in at least part of Idaho, because about half of Idaho has a very large Mormon population in the parts that border on Utah. And so we expect this to be a pretty reasonable day for Mitt Romney. The big contested question mark state everybody's looking at is Ohio.
Ohio is so interesting. It's got so much in common with Michigan, where Mitt Romney did well, but what it lacks is the one thing that may have given Mitt Romney the 3 or 4 points he needed to win, which is home state ties and a father who's still fondly remembered.
Revered, even.
Yes, revered by especially older Michiganders who came out in pretty big numbers and broke for Mitt Romney on Tuesday. And so the big question is, without that built-in advantage, what does Mitt Romney have in Ohio?
Well, maybe he should change his name to Mitt Rhodes so he could do that governor-father thing again in Ohio. But if anyone, really,
Mitt
Rick
Taft, what do you think of that?
Mitt Taft.
Are the
I actually
still
liked
popular?
Mitt Taft.
Mitt Taft.
Well,
yeah.
Some of them are. They didn't do so well in the most recent round of their generational reiteration, but they still are legendary. If anyone has close ties, really, in Ohio, it would be Rick Santorum, oddly enough, because his part of Pennsylvania, where, while he wasn't born there, he did grow up there and, of course, was elected to office there, is western Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh end of the state. And that is not dissimilar to the eastern and southern portions of Ohio. There are a lot of social conservatives there in the Republican Party in both cases. And I think he speaks the speak and he walks the walk.
That's right. We think about a third of Ohio's electorate on Tuesday will be made up of social conservatives. And, you know, it's possible also that Santorum's blue-collar economic message might go over well in Ohio, as it went over reasonably well in Michigan.
That's right. And Santorum has had a lead, a pretty substantial lead, sort of high to low and back and forth, single digits lead in Ohio up to now. The question being, of course, does he lose that, given the stronger performance by Mitt Romney in Michigan, big dominant performance in Arizona? Do the twin wins do for him what the trifecta Tuesday on February 7th did for Rick Santorum? Does it establish that sort of momentum and mojo that people seem to be looking for in primaries?
But if the trend lines continue, it looks like Super Tuesday could be a muddying day, not a clarifying day for
That's
this
right.
race.
And really, the bar is not set too high at this point, which is probably a good thing for Mitt Romney. He doesn't have to win everywhere. He doesn't even have to win half those 10 events. If he can just win 3, 4, 5, including Ohio, we assume Massachusetts, perhaps Vermont, Virginia, maybe Idaho. If he can add Ohio, he will win the preponderance, I believe, of the analysis on that day, and probably the preponderance of actual committed delegates, which is a whole nother can of worms. As we've seen again and again, after we have these votes, sometimes there's no committed delegates at all, really, such as in Iowa or in Colorado, Minnesota. Didn't seem to hold back all of us in the media who got very excited about Rick Santorum winning those events.
That's right. And what's striking in terms of the dynamics of the race is Santorum's seeming inability to drive that narrative, to get out there and say, you know what, I actually did pretty well in Michigan, even though Mitt Romney won the statewide popular vote. And that, you know, as we've seen at several points in this race, speaks to the organizational shortcomings of Santorum's candidacy.
That's right.
That haunted him time and again.
Also, there seems to be a tendency, we've seen this again and again, whoever wins, whoever has a good night on one of these Tuesdays, seems the very next day to say something or to step in something in some way or another to diminish their own performance the day before. And in this case, we had Mitt Romney with these two wins. And by the way, the Arizona win was quite a thumping. It was 20-21 percentage points. He took home all the delegates because of winner-take-all rules, which could be contested later at the convention, but for now looked pretty good on TV. And yet the very next day, he sits down with an interviewer, misapprehends a question that was kind of involved about contraception and the Blunt Amendment in the Senate and so on, and says, oh, well, I'm not on the bill. Well, that was interpreted, at least initially, to mean he wasn't supporting the Blunt Amendment, which is the religious liberty exception to the government telling any employer that they have to cover contraception in their insurance plans for employees. This is a big vote. It's happening in the Senate. We assume it'll go down on party lines, and that vote is taking place as we do this podcast. But it was an odd moment because then his campaign within minutes has to come back and say, no, the candidate, it was all a misunderstanding. And the candidate really has the opposite position of what he said. And then he had to come out and say the same thing. Not what you'd call a triumphant day after.
No, the last thing Mitt Romney needed just days before states like Oklahoma, Tennessee, Georgia, and let us not forget Ohio, cast their votes on Super Tuesday. Giving social conservatives a chance to think maybe he's not with us.
That's right. Rick Santorum would never have made this mistake. As soon as you start into the subject area, he knows exactly what he wants to say, and he has no contradictions in his own mind, which in a sense is a great asset for a candidate, maybe not the world's greatest asset for somebody in governing, but clearly an asset of the kind that has kept him in this race far past the point anyone last fall would have projected, probably even including Rick Santorum. Speaking of staying in the race, what's keeping Newt Gingrich alive?
Well, that's a great question. Obviously, he sees Georgia as a big opportunity for a comeback. Georgia is the single largest delegate haul on Tuesday night, and he's spending a lot of time there. He's calling in a lot of favors. He's seeing a lot of old friends, doing a lot of campaign events. But one does wonder what path forward there is for Newt if he doesn't win Georgia. And even if he does win Georgia, what path forward is there?
Here's a question. In the old days, as we've said many times, once a candidate had not done well in Iowa and New Hampshire and did not have a clear path beyond those initial states, their fundraising disappeared. It just dried up. But in this year, of course, we have this new way by which super wealthy people can fund candidates and keep them going almost on the strength of that one person's contribution, in this case, Sheldon Adelson, the casino owner from Las Vegas. He is, to a large degree, the wind beneath Newt Gingrich's wings at this point, is he not?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And there are reports that Adelson has just made another contribution. We don't know exactly how much, but we assume that it is large. There's also an alternative theory out here, which you've advanced before, which is that Sheldon Adelson is keeping Newt Gingrich alive to tamp down Rick Santorum, who many see as, at this point, the most viable conservative alternative to Romney and the biggest threat to a Romney coronation.
So Adelson has decided that his guy is Newt, but if it's not Newt, then he'd rather see Mitt Romney because he doesn't like Rick Santorum. I mean, Rick Santorum is a very strong supporter of Israel, which is a major concern of Sheldon Adelson's.
But you have this years-long personal relationship between Adelson and Gingrich, which must count for something.
And Adelson must also think that perhaps Santorum would not be the best way to win the White House. Mm-hmm. And obviously what he wants is to get rid of Barack Obama,
yes,
and install a president he thinks is, yes, friendlier to Israel and probably feels that way about Mitt Romney.
And that's what unifies this entire set of a couple dozen deep-pocketed donors who are, you know, writing checks that to us seem large but to them might seem quite small.
Most of these people have been business people. Most of them have been folks who have made hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in business. But we saw a new entry into the Super PAC group this past week. Bill Maher, the television personality, comedian, talk show host, weighed in with $1 million contribution to the Super PAC for Barack Obama.
That's right. In the recent filings we've seen with the FEC, it's mostly been Republicans who've been contributing to the Super PACs, and that makes sense because the Republicans have an active race that's getting a lot of media attention, and maybe the Democrats have sort of been holding back and thinking, we'll wait for the general, we'll give in a few months. The only individual who'd given more than $1 million to date was Jeffrey Katzenberg, who'd given $2 million to Priorities USA Action, which is the Super PAC supporting President Obama. And now Bill Maher has entered the fold. It sure seems like dozens more will follow suit.
That would seem to be at least what we've been told by many observers, including many Republicans, saying, stop making this out to look like it's some sort of a conservative plot. You're going to see just as much money coming from the other side, including from labor unions. And by the way, President Obama chose the day of the Michigan primary this past week to speak to the UAW meeting here in Washington, D.C., and gave a speech that was clearly a precursor, if you will, a little preview of the campaign he plans to run this fall.
Yeah, very animated, amped up, excited campaign style event.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
The economy is getting stronger. The recovery is speeding up. Now is time to keep our foot on the gas, not put on the brakes. And I'm not going to settle for a country where just a few do really well and everybody else is struggling to get by.
What Obama's appearance before the UAW this week showed is that he believes that the federal bailout of the auto companies, of GM and Chrysler specifically, is going to be a really important issue in the fall. And Romney won Michigan, holding firm to his opposition of the billions of dollars that went to those two companies. His other three rivals opposed it as well. Didn't seem to hurt him in Michigan, where lots of Republican voters agree with him that it was a bad idea. But it's clear that as we move into the fall and Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania become absolutely pivotal, fought-over states, the auto bailout is going to be one of the dominant themes of the general election.
Absolutely. And one of the other things that looks like it's going to be exciting this fall is watching to see what happens to control of the Senate. Now, it was not very long ago that a lot of us were just shaking our heads and saying, that's gone. The Democrats have lost control of the Senate. And the reason for that was almost entirely numeric. The Democrats were defending 22 seats and the Republicans just 11. And the Democrats had a big slug of retirees. They had all these people going out, Danny Akaka, Jeff Bingaman, Kent Conrad, Herb Kohl, James Webb in Virginia, and finally Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson in Nebraska. Wow. I mean, they're losing all of those, and in most of those states, that seat was either gone or looking like it was going to be extremely difficult to defend. Even Hawaii was going to be a tough call for them because of Linda Lingle running as the Republican. The Republicans only had two, Kay Bailey Hutchison in Texas, safe Republican seat. John Kyle in Arizona, probably a safe Republican seat. So it looked like the Senate was going to go Republican. It's only a very narrow margin now, 51-47, with two independents who organize with the Democrats. So it was over and done.
But then a major surprise this week, out of nowhere, Olympia Snowe, who's a three-term senator, but who first arrived in Congress in 1979, announced that she would not be running for re-election this
fall.
And
this was not on anybody's radar screen. This was, no one was talking about Olympia Snowe up in Maine. She, at one point, had kind of a stiff challenge in the primary, but that seems to have largely evanesced. And now, well, everyone expected her to cruise to re-election.
And there are 2 weeks left to gather signatures to get on the ballot in Maine. Maine has two congressional districts, two House members, both Democrats. Shelley Pingree, who lost in a Senate race to Susan Collins back in 2002, and Michael Michoud. They both announced yesterday that they're gathering signatures. There were already, I think, about four Democrats, a handful of Democrats, who were pursuing the nomination. But the Republicans missed a major signature gathering and recruiting opportunity, which were the main caucuses that ended a few weeks ago. And they don't have an obvious person to turn to.
Which is why everyone's wondering, why is Olympia Snow retiring right now? I mean, wouldn't she wanted to have made this announcement 6 months ago? The explanation that she made was, I've gotten tired of the Senate and all the partisanship, and there's nothing left for those of us who are centrists, and I'm just really just tired of the way these people act, and I could do more to encourage bipartisanship and solutions to our nation's problems from outside the Senate. Well, okay, fine, but that didn't develop overnight. The only cloud on Olympia Snow's horizon that I can think of is that way back last year there was an announcement that the Justice Department was looking into some of these for-profit college organizations that have processed a lot of student loans, billions of dollars in student loans over the years, and they were investigating the particular one that's run by Olympia Snow's husband, a former congressman named John McKernan.
That's right, and we don't think that Olympia Snow is in any way a subject of this investigation, but it does seem to be the only cloud on the horizon, as you say.
Speaking of clouds on the horizon, there seems to be a fog around Bob Kerrey. There is a former governor of Nebraska, former senator, former presidential candidate. A lot of people forget that he ran for president in 1992 for a while, lost to Bill Clinton. And Bob Kerrey is an extraordinarily brilliant personality who has spent the last 10 years or so while he's been out of the United States Senate as the president of the New School in Manhattan, in New York. Not exactly a Nebraska kind of thing to do.
Right. That's right. Not Manhattan, Nebraska, or the Upper West Side of Nebraska. That's right. He's been building an empire at the New School and has drawn a lot of top talent there and has raised a lot of money and raised the profile of the institution. But over the years, he's had a reputation as a guy who sometimes has a little trouble making up his mind and follows some meandering path through life, marches to the beat of his own drummer. And so a couple weeks ago, he announced that he wouldn't be seeking the Democratic nomination for the Senate seat in Nebraska. And then this week, he reversed himself and said, yep, I'm doing it. I'm in.
Pretty remarkable, very Bob Kerrey-like. And, of course, there is already a Democrat who was running for that seat. This is the Ben Nelson seat we mentioned before, that Ben Nelson was retiring. And there are some Republicans in the field, too. And right now, the polls would tend to indicate that those Republicans are more in sync with what Nebraskans are expected to do in the presidential election in November, which is basically to vote Republican, whoever that candidate is.
And one suspects that Ben Nelson got out when he did, because he saw that this might be a very tough year for him with Nebraska voters, where they might finally say, you know what, we've essentially got a Republican. We've got a very conservative Democrat who occasionally votes with Republicans. Let's just get ourselves a Republican.
So now two races do not entirely turn around the landscape. We still have two-thirds of the seats that are open this year being Democratic seats that have to be defended. We only have these three Republican retirements, and only the Olympia Snow seat looks likely to go Democratic. Not certain, of course, or probable, but just likely at this juncture because we don't know who the Republican candidate is. Going back to the Democratic side, Nebraska is still a question mark at best, but at least that's a little better than a slam dunk for the Republicans. Maybe North Dakota is a little more competitive. Wisconsin's competitive. Virginia looks competitive. Maybe Connecticut stays Democratic. So it comes down to defending the Hawaii seat, the New Mexico seat, and some of the incumbents, like Claire McCaskill in Missouri, for example, who have got tough challengers and have kind of some tough sledding to go to get back into the Senate in November.
That's right. There are a handful of Democratic incumbents who are going to have to work hard over the next 8 months. It looks like, in all likelihood, Sherrod Brown is okay for now.
Which is remarkable.
Which is remarkable.
Because Ohio has been trending Republican of late, and Sherrod Brown, of course, got in 2006 when they were having a real spasm of Democratic love.
It looks like Bill Nelson in Florida will have a real race on his hands. John Tester out in Montana will have a real race on
real
his hands
toss-up.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, McCaskill, as you mentioned.
Well, whether the Democrats hold on or not, and I would say at this point it's no better than a 50-50 bet either way, but whether they hold on or not, one thing we're not going to have in the Senate is nearly as many people in the middle.
It's pretty remarkable. You look back 5 years in the Senate to a time when you had Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island, Arlen Specter after he was a Democrat and before he became a Democrat again. You had both of the senators from Maine, Jim Jeffords from Vermont, George Voinovich. Think about the set of Republican senators who voted against the conviction of Bill Clinton in the Senate in 1999.
Yes, revenge has come for just about all of them.
That's right. And on the Democratic side, Nelson's on the way out. Evan Bayh is already gone. Joe Lieberman, an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, is on the way out. So you have to wonder, when you have an institution that's filled with more partisan Democrats and more partisan Republicans and filled with people who haven't been there for very long, what does that mean for the process of making laws?
Yes, that's right. It appears at this point that of all those Republicans you named, the only one who will be left next year will be Susan Collins. So as you get all these partisans together in an institution where you have to have 60 votes to do anything that matters and nobody wants to compromise with the other side, it may not matter who's got 51 votes and who has 49. It's going to be in irons, even worse than it is now.
Ron, I know you and Ken often end the podcast with farewells. And as we tape this, we just got the news a couple hours ago of the death of the conservative journalist and web tycoon Andrew Breitbart, dead at 43 years of age, lived in Los Angeles, a longtime associate of Matt Drudge, also helped Arianna Huffington get the Huffington Post going on the other side of the ideological spectrum, but a conservative provocateur, colorful guy.
Yes, agent provocateur is a good way to describe him, perhaps best known for the work that he did with James O'Keefe, the guerrilla videographer who was responsible for bringing down Acorn with his videos of people within some of their organizations, and also going after Mary Landrieu's office staff in New Orleans, the senator there, and a number of other groups, including NPR, where a couple of people posing as potential donors met with a former official or development official of NPR. So Andrew Breitbart was always a controversial figure. He was somebody that some conservatives were uncomfortable with. He gave a real barn burner Stemwinder speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference here in Washington just last month. A lot of people enormously shocked to see his career cut so short.
That's right. And Breitbart will be remembered for, among many other things, bringing to the world's attention an out-of-context video of an Obama administration Agriculture Department official named Shirley Sherrod. A lot of people probably haven't thought about Shirley Sherrod in a while. She appeared to be making racist comments, but when the full video was later played, it turned out that she wasn't. And she was later exonerated after being fired by the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. But it must be noted, Andrew Breitbart also brought to the world's attention the tweets of former Congressman Anthony Weiner, which raised serious questions about his personal behavior.
That brought to an end the political career of Anthony Weiner. And that brings to an end this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Neil Carruth.
Join us again next week when the wandering boy Ken Rudin will be with us again for It's All Politics from NPR.